Hello, and welcome to Words and Pictures, the show all about the narrative arts scene. I'm S.W. Conser, and today we're roaming the galleries of the Portland Art Museum, talking with the people behind the exhibition Animating Life, the Art, Science, and Wonder of Laika. Animating Life is a show all about the stop-motion artistry behind the films of Laika Entertainment, including Coraline, Paranorman, The Box Trolls, and Kubo and the Two Strings. I'm talking now with Brad Wald. He's the CFO and head of business operations at Laika. Thank you for talking with us in Words and Pictures.
You're so welcome. Pleasure to speak to you.
I know that there have been a lot of activities planned for this exhibition geared towards students.
Yes.
So for more traditional museum patrons, what can they expect to see and find out about and learn about in this particular art exhibition?
Absolutely. We'll have different programs that explore animation itself, having our animators show how stop-motion animation is done, 24 frames in a second. We'll have our puppet makers show inside a puppet with its armature, its skeleton, and all that goes into it. We'll have different talks about our visual effects and how we blend age-old stop-motion with new age technology. So this museum, to me, in my mind, kicks off an amazing journey that we'll have with the Portland Art Museum, and we're going to activate it with many programs, screenings, educational tours, classes, panel discussions. So we're going to be very active. All of my team will be supporting that. But then we hope to take this show on the road.
Brad Wald, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Such a pleasure.
And now we're talking with animator, professor, and media artist Rose Bond, who is the curatorial advisor for the Animating Life exhibit at the Portland Art Museum. Well, Rose, what did you want to spotlight when you were helping curate this exhibit? What did you want to really focus on in bringing out the art? In some ways, it's a bit of an editing job, isn't it?
Yeah, it's this idea of craft and artistry, and that's always a bit dodgy area to get into. It's like, what is craft, what is art, and all that kind of stuff. So I was looking at the idea of the handmade, and I was looking at why Laika, why Portland, not just because Travis was born nearby, but that there is this respect, I think, for the handmade, for DIY, we'll figure it out, we'll do it off pattern, thank you, that I think Laika, in all of its, you know, sort of corporate success, still maintains. And I thought that was an interesting thing to look for as a kind of a thread. Will that be in this show? And being here today and seeing it is like, yeah, it's definitely there. And the conversation I just had with these key people at Laika, just to see how they interact with each other and how interdependent that they are, organic almost in how they're working, just seemed really different from a Hollywood model and really, really a good fit for Portland.
I'm wondering if you're sort of threading the needle between high and low, commercial craft and fine art. Did that enter your mind when you're helping curate what the traditional art museum patron might be looking for and might not be crazy about?
You know, I think we live in this world where definitions are getting very blurry. My work is like, what is it? Is it art? Is it animation? I'm in that world all the time. And, you know, some people are saying the screen is the new canvas. I read that in the New York Times. But it's like the content of this stuff has been for a long time dictated by certain narrow parameters in Hollywood. And I think breaking away, being in Portland, being steeped in kind of the value stuff that comes out in this city. But I think getting back to your question, again, I'm not sure about this sort of threading the line. If you look at what's happening in Japan, there's a line between commercial and art. It's not there. It's not there. And I just think the art world's got to open up, that it will. And I think the commercial world needs to look at broader audiences or more specialized audiences, whatever. The messaging, who's not there? Who keeps being left out? I do think that you have to remember that this is not the first museum showcase for animated work, that Tim Burton had a show at the Museum of Modern Art. So, and that was really well attended. And don't think that Brian, the head of this museum, didn't note and read those stats on that. So the public is interested in not just this sort of Western classic canon of art, but I think the public is interested in the art in Italian design cars or motorcycles or animation.
Rose Bond, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Conch. Keep it up.
So now I'm talking with Nelson Lowry. He's the production designer at Leica. And Nelson, why don't you tell our listeners what all of that entails?
I'm one of the designers of the films, and that means I actually work with the director in designing the look and feel of the film.
So you have a lot to do with the sets, with the environment, with the neighborhoods and landscapes that the characters move around in.
Yes, with everything. I mean, the characters and the costumes often come first, but then I build the sort of world around them. And that can mean vehicles, the woods, houses, caves, just kind of every potential environment that the story might take you to.
One of the really standout features of the film Paranorman was that practically all of the buildings and streets, cars, features were all asymmetrical. They didn't mirror left to right. They had a skew to them, and it sort of added that off-kilter feel to the film.
Yeah, that sort of asymmetrical design was something that Chris Butler, the director, wanted, and it was of course the shops didn't initially love it because there wasn't a single straight line in the film, but it was so fun to design that. I got to take the director out to the East Coast, and we walked around, and I'm telling you, some of those old neighborhoods, they are kind of like that. I mean, the old architecture and things that were built early on all had a weird slant and a lean to them. So, you know, because Norman wasn't a normal kid and he lived in this kind of crazy world, we wanted the look and feel of the world around him to reflect that.
Give us a story about starting from scratch, starting from drawings that come to you and making 3D structures out of them that in some way hold together in the viewer's eye.
That's a great question, and it's a difficult discipline. So we want to design something that is memorable, it's beautiful, it's interesting, but not too interesting, in so much that it really is there to support the story. And so, you know, what I do is I start with a lot of reference. I try to visit a location if possible, and then some thumbnails and some sketches, and it's all working towards creating these environments that are not just cool, but are viable. I mean, we actually have to build them and finish the film. So, you know, that's kind of a long process. It takes about 9 months to a year. A lot of illustrations, a lot of what I call proof of concept, which are little physically built sections of the illustrations that we're working on. And then we place the characters within them and photograph them and show them in a theater, you know, for the group. And we talk about, will this work as a film? So it takes a while. And there's many, many steps along the way, but it's such a fun thing to do because there's so much invention that goes into every one of those steps.
In the Box Trolls, the whole environment, it has just impossible geography, impossible architecture, all sort of hanging by a thread, almost waiting to fall over. Putting that environment together, was that fun? Was it aggravating? I mean, what was involved in trying to make something clearly absurd look believable?
Box Trolls, that was extremely difficult. You know, when you do a what's called a napkin sketch at the beginning of a project, and that's just jotting down some sort of lyrical kind of line quality, you often have to clean that up and make it less crazy so that you can actually build it. Well, that didn't happen on Box Trolls. We stayed with that. Paul Lassane, who was the production designer of that film, worked with a couple of amazing artists, and they really pushed that aesthetic into every single set and prop. And it was a very challenging show to build because of it. But if anybody does get a chance to come by and see the show here at Portland Art Museum, there's a few sets. One of them is a, sort of a grand hall that there's a dance sequence in. And you'll see the impossible, not a straight line, not a flat surface, and then the patterns and colors and specular put on top of them. It made for just absolutely spectacular sets, that aesthetic.
How did you fall into this job? You say you made things all your life. What led you to this place?
Well, it goes back quite a ways. But, you know, my mom was a miniaturist, and my dad built some dioramas for museums. He was also an industrial designer. Mom was an illustrator. I went to art school. I immediately, getting out of art college, went to New York and worked in theater and did commercials. I am an obsessive builder, and that turned into designer, but I still make things. It's my happiest place I go to. I still come home after, you know, a 10-hour day and go into my studio and make things myself. So it's a lifelong passion.
Nelson Lowry, it's been great to talk with you today.
You as well, and I encourage anybody who can get down to the Portland Art Museum to come check it out, because it's one thing to see the film, another one to stand inches away and see these beautiful costumes and props and characters.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm S.W. Konser, and I'm here at the Portland Art Museum, where the exhibition Animating Life, the Art, Science, and Wonder of Leica is underway. All right, now I'm with Rich Garrity. He is the president for Stratasys, which manufactures the 3D printers that turn out all of the puppets for these features. And Rich, help us demystify the term RP, or rapid prototyping. This is a version of 3D printing that's used in the animation industry, and really, how does it work?
Yeah, so prototyping allows any designer, any engineer, to take an idea, turn it into a computer-aided design file, take that file, and essentially print it, and turn that design or idea that they have in their head into something that's real, that's tangible, that's physical. So rapid prototyping with 3D printing is really about fast iteration. So have an idea, get it printed, get a sense for what it feels like, looks like, tests, and so forth. Go back, you may tweak the idea a little bit because you don't like something in a particular feature. It's a simple tweak on the computer file. You print again, you've got a new update in your hands in a matter of hours. And so what it does is it greatly compresses the cycle of how you go from idea to creation. Whereas traditional means of making things over the years, there's many steps and many hours involved with getting something made. 3D printing allows you to have something right next to you and be able to iterate product design overnight. Leica is a great example of that. We started working with Leica 10 years ago, but it was really Kubo and the two strings that took the partnership to a whole new level. They've come to us and said, look, this is the type of intricacy, the fine feature detail, the level of colors that we need to achieve to make the films appear much more lifelike. And so 3D printing allows Leica to be able to do this seamlessly, really cut down on the time it takes to get the puppets, and allows them to get a level of intricacy and detail that you just can't achieve with any traditional manufacturing method.
Rich Garrity, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Well, I'm here now with Brian McLean, the Director of Rapid Prototyping at Leica. And Brian, so you are responsible for taking these concept drawings. Sometimes you have character designers who are working with pencil and paper, or more likely graphics tablets. And you have to translate that into 3D character models. So What is the process like with that?
That's a great question. And the way that we go about that is we actually will first, there's an interim step where a character design goes from 2D to being 3D, and it's first sculpted in clay. So we have a very talented group of sculptors who will take these character designs, translate them into a three-dimensional object. And this is the first time that the crew has really seen how this character is going to look in 3D. The rapid prototyping department will take that sculpt, which is called a maquette, and we will scan that with 3D scanners, and we will bring that into the computer, and then we will rebuild the head to ready to be animated. So it's called retopologizing, where we'll actually be building out this maquette, and we'll give it a mesh that we wrap over the face that we'll then later be able to animate and turn and break into a puppet. The maquette is also then given to the puppet department, and they start using that as their blueprint to figure out how they're going to build the rest of the body of the puppet.
So you started out working in clay yourself when you were a lot younger, and rapid prototyping, so switching out faces and facial expressions, doesn't have quite that metamorphosis potential that clay does. But are you trying to, in the technology you're doing these days, are you trying to get back to more of that transformational quality that clay has?
Yeah, the amazing thing about replacement animation is the sky's the limit as far as what you can do with a performance. With the computers and the way that we're able to, you know, control subtlety, you can have a character that has amazingly subtle and fine movements, and then you can have that same character go into an extreme facial expression, or even morph from one face to another, or one character to another. So replacement animation has the benefit of really being able to do anything that you can do in clay.
Brian McLean, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks.
You're listening to a special episode of Words and Pictures, all about the art of Leica entertainment. I'm S.W. Konser, here at the Portland Art Museum, where the exhibition Animating Life is underway. Now I'm talking with Steve Emerson. He's the visual effects supervisor at Leica. Welcome to Words and Pictures, Steve.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
So tell us a little bit about your department and what people can see at the exhibition that shows off the whole range of visual effects.
Well, stop motion animation, if you haven't already gotten the idea, it is a precarious art. You know, we will create shots and animate performances that sometimes they take days, weeks, months. And over the course of realizing those performances, inevitably things are going to go wrong. And so part of the responsibilities of the visual effects department is we come in and we clean up the mess afterwards. The flip side of that is we're very much about enabling storytellers. So the art of stop motion animation, it can be very limited in terms of the types of stories you can tell. So if you look at a lot of these classic films, you don't see a lot of characters, you don't see many environments, you don't see costume changes, you don't see big, you know, Hollywood-style effects. So if you're a storyteller that's looking to tell a specific story or make a film using stop-motion animation, oftentimes you're asked to simplify. Kind of the idea with Leica is we wanted to stop that. We love stop-motion animation, but we didn't want to make any type of concessions with the stories that we wanted to tell. And we were going to get there by introducing technology into the mix. But at the same time, we wanted to make sure that if we were bringing technology into a stop motion world, that we were doing so in a way that is ultimately respectful of and honors the art form. So in terms of this exhibition here, some of the things that you could see that we're certainly very, very much involved in, when you walk into the foyer, and you see the hollow bone skeleton, which is the largest stop-motion puppet that's ever been created, and no other studio on Earth would be insane enough to take that thing on. Right? That thing, you can imagine, it gets out on the stages, they're building scaffolding, and it's got all kinds of rigging and wires, and you have an animator that is like physically climbing all over this thing, working as hard as he or she possibly could to hopefully get a second of animation out of it a week. Believe me, when those shots dropped, there was a lot of problems and a lot of things that we had to clean up. So just have a look at that skeleton and imagine what it took to bring to life. and imagine what it probably looked like when it came over to visual effects to do the additional digital touch-up work. You'll see that here on the monitors at the exhibition as well. You'll see a lot of behind the scenes. We have some of the original prototypes here that were used to inspire the water system for Kubo. If you're making a film and it's going to involve big, giant oceans and waves, you know, typically for live-action filmmaking, you're going to hire a bunch of artists that understand software. You start building oceans. At Leica, we just want to make sure that ultimately what ends up on the screen, it feels like it belongs in these universes, right? So what we did was we enlist the animation team and the rigging team and the stage techs, and they build us water systems that if we were able to shoot them in camera, here's what it would look like. And then we can look at these different animation prototypes that they built, those performances, those characteristics, and we can key off of all of that and digitize it and ultimately fold something into a universe that feels like it belongs.
It sounds like one of the things that you're trying to do with visual effects is really expand the landscape. You mentioned this giant oceanscape in Kubo and the Two Strings.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that back in the early days of stop motion puppet animation, it would have been implied, but the viewer still would see what looked like a stage, what looked like a very limited stage.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're really trying to integrate the art forms to get beyond that sense of a stage.
Sure. For me, when I go to the movies, I want to be told a great story. I want it to be executed really, really well. I also want to be able to connect with the characters. I want to be able to empathize with those characters. I want to experience what I'm seeing and believe what I'm seeing. And a lot of that is achieved through strong visual effects, through great lighting. And again, when you're talking about, you know, classic stop motion films, you can certainly be swept up in the story. But I guess what we're really trying to do here is to take audiences to a place where they are experiencing the world of those characters, they are connecting with those characters, and ultimately, hopefully, being moved emotionally by those performances. So a lot of it is it's not only about being respectful of the art, but also driving a realism into it that will hopefully bring people into the story and let them forget that they're experiencing something that, you know, it's not real. It's being done one frame at a time. And somebody out in a warehouse in Hillsborough built it with a hammer and some wood, a bunch of nails and some paint.
Steve Emerson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Enjoy the exhibition. And for everybody else out there, please come check it out. It is so cool.
So I'm talking with Georgina Haynes. She's the head of puppet fabrication at Leica. And there's a great deal of full puppets and partial puppets and all sorts of puppetry here at this Animating Life exhibition.
There is indeed. You know, we're so proud that we are putting together the largest exhibition of our work from over the last sort of 12 years of making the feature films we've been making in Portland, in Oregon, our sort of hometown. We have taken from Coraline, from Paranorman, from Box Trolls, and from Kubo and the Two Strings, and we're trying to show the highlights of our art form. Of course, my department is the puppet department, and I've been lucky enough to be with the department since its conception. And, you know, what's amazing is that I work with an incredible team, around about 80, 85 artists and craftspeople. And it's not just one person beavering away making a puppet. It's a team of people that come together collaboratively. It's designers, it's mechanical engineers, it's jewelers. We have people who make miniature hair. Some of them come from hairdressing, full-size hairdressing. Some of them come from model making. So we pull from all of these different skill sets. And, you know, when an artist comes into my department, they will come with a skill. Maybe it's not a puppet making skill, but then we will help sort of nurture that skill into the world that we're involved in, this small scale, intricate world. So, you know, what's great is we're trying to give people a glimpse behind the scenes of how that's done and things that are half made, so you can see through the sort of the shiny surfaces to what the guts of a puppet are, you know, what the skeleton is, what's going on underneath it. How does a stop motion puppet work?
I remember when the first feature from Leica came out, Coraline, there were people you had on staff who were master knitters who were making miniature custom sweaters and other sort of togs.
You know, it's so interesting. We look back at those days, and the big thing on Coraline was the fact that we used a miniature knitter. And, you know, she was actually, she didn't work in Portland. We found her. She was mother of, I think, triplets. And so she had her own world, but she had this incredible talent, this art form of taking almost thread-sized needles and making these miniature knitted jumpers and sweaters. The interesting thing is, that was like early foundations of us building our costume department. And now, what they do in the costume department is, you know, they've taken miniature pattern making, they actually make their own fabrics now. So before, we were just doing miniature standardized knitting. Now we're making our own knitwear out of silk threads, out of, you know, and we're using different ways in which to make our costumes so that they're in style to the film. You know, if you do something traditional like just taking a real life sweater and miniaturizing it down, sometimes it won't always hit the design lines of the film. So we're looking more at the sort of the whole look and design concept as part of the costume making. So yeah, we're making so many different fabrics, embellished fabrics, knitwear, but not through the conventional way. Yeah, so it was a starting point.
Apart from the parts of the puppet that you can see, the facial expressions, the costumes, the props, the hair, there's also underneath the things you can't see, in particular, the structure called an armature.
Yeah.
And if you were to look at it without the puppet skin on it, it might look like a miniature version of the Terminator.
You know, that's very well described. So I started as an armature maker in stop motion. I loved all aspects of it, but I just fell into armature making. And they are essentially the skeleton of a puppet. But the skeleton of a puppet is not like a human skeleton, because it has to hold the puppet in place frame by frame. So every joint that is in the articulated sort of framework of that armature has to have enough tension in it to hold it in place against skin, against costume, you know. And the armature makers, along with, I would say, the mold makers and the casters of a puppet, are the unsung heroes, because you don't see their work, and yet it's so important to the performance of the puppet. You know, stop motion has been around for 100 years, and even 100 years ago, they were making armatures for stop motion puppets based on ball and socket joints, hinge joints, you know. But we've taken sort of that initial information and then also combined it with technology, which allows us to perfect the art form of muscle movement and oh, this character's got wings. How are we going to make these wings move? So, yeah, the armatures are an amazing structure, which is almost, I always liken it to a Swiss watchmaker. Our armature makers are like Swiss watchmakers. They're making these tiny sort of jewelry-inspired skeletal forms that help propel those puppets and bring them to life and help the animators bring them to life.
I've noticed that over the past few years in particular, stop motion studios like Leica, like Aardman, like Bent Image Lab have been really miniaturizing the joints and the parts of the armatures and doing a lot more machining, doing a lot more custom work to make everything more flexible and more adaptable.
Yeah, what we've done is we've embraced technology as it comes to us. You know, we're not scared of using modern technology to enhance our art form. And I think that the fusion of technology and the best craftspeople that there are is probably what Leica has become best known for. And I do think Aardman, Bent Image Lab, McKinnon and Saunders, they're all pulling from what is around them in the world and then taking this age-old art form, catapulting it into the modern world. And, you know, for us as artists, who we've been very lucky at Leica that we have been building our art and craft and technology for 12 years at this point. And each film, we want to do something bigger and better, or smaller and better, you know. And we've now made the largest armature ever to be in existence, with the skeleton in the Hall of Bones on Kubo, and in Kubo as well, the smallest armature, which is in the tiny Hanzo, that is about 3/4 inch tall, that's fully articulated. So you're right, we're always either going as small as possible or as large. And also what that's done is we are building our machine shop, we're building our technology on site. You know, initially we would have outside engineers working for us, but as Leica has grown, all of those sort of the machine shops have grown as well. So
I'd love to hear a story or two about when some concept artist came up to you with a crazy idea and you said, oh man, but you wanted to beat the challenge. Maybe there's a lot of trial and error, but you learned a lot along the way.
Yeah, you know, that is every film that we work on. Whenever we see a character design lineup and we hear from the animator what they want that puppet to do, it's like, whoa, how are we going to do that? I would say probably to date, when they came to us on Kubo and asked for a fully furred monkey to be fighting like a ninja warrior on a ship without any crawl or chatter in its fur, that was a huge challenge. And we all looked in fear at the director and the animators. How are we going to do it? But we did it. We did it with the materials that were on hand, the expertise that had grown through the years. And we also looked at different techniques of puppet making rather than the standardized. We sculpt it, we mold it, we make an armature. With monkey, we wanted to get that real animal-like muscle sort of feel. So we actually built a muscle structure that went over the top of the armature and then covered it in a fur fabric suit, which we then painted with silicone so that it didn't chatter and so that it was on style of the movie. So often the challenges that are presented to you are what make the artistry of the final piece as well. You know, overcoming some of those physical challenges, practical challenges, you end up, it helps and enhances the look of the puppet, the performance of the puppet. So yeah, that was a huge one. And I would say the sister puppets, what a beautiful design. I think one of the most beautifully designed puppets I'd ever seen. And then the director said, well, those capes, we'd like those capes to turn into feathered wings. And we also want them to fight like ninjas with the feathered wings. So we, you know, we work with this really amazing armature maker, puppet maker, Patrick Zung. And he came in and he literally wove a pattern of piano wire into the shape of the wings. And at each woven point where the wires crossed, they acted as a kind of like fan that could fan in on itself. And every point hinged on itself. So this cape would open out. And on the outside of the cape, there was laser-cut feathers, which were attached to every articulation point. So it was essentially squashing and stretching so that it could hang as a cape, yet it could open out as feathered wings. And the first prototype he did of that, we showed it to Travis, and Travis was, his mouth hit the floor. You know, he'd given us this challenge, and I don't think he ever thought that we were going to be able to rise to it and also sort of make this thing that looks so beautiful. So yeah, that was an incredible moment.
Now, what was the path that led you to this position of head of puppet fabrication? What sort of fun detours along the way brought you to this point?
You know, my path has been fun. I was the kid that was an academic. My doodles in the back of my textbook were way more impressive than my math or my English. But I had this love and this understanding of art and craft. I just made things. My mum poured a big pile of fabrics in the middle of the living room floor when I was 4 years old and went, my daughter's never going to be bored, make something. And I made a real big mess and I made some art. And my dad was like, oh no, my house is never going to be tidy. But I was very lucky. My parents encouraged me to follow my own path. So when I was at school and academia wasn't for me, they said, but you're a great artist. Do your art. So I pursued an artistic path all the way through school, through college. And then at the same time, I collected old Victorian dolls. I wanted to make my own dolls, but I was in a very fine art-based college. And my lecturers, they were great, but they did not understand me making dolls. They were like, no, you're too talented an artist just to make dolls. So the puppet thing came out of that, me trying to get around my really cool art lecturers, but trying to make them understand, no, these could be really interesting. So I actually started studying the history of puppetry and how I could interpret that with my skill set, started making puppets, hand puppets, string puppets, rod puppets, and then found this crazy world of animation. Was lucky enough to get an apprenticeship at a company called Cosgrove Hall, which was famous for Wind in the Willows and lots of other kids' stop-motion TV series, and basically my talents grew out of that.
Georgina Haynes, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And enjoy the exhibition. It's open until May and everybody should come and see it. It explains all about stop motion, the wizardry of stop motion animation.
You've been listening to a special episode of Words and Pictures here in the galleries of the Portland Art Museum, where the exhibition Animating Life is underway. Thanks to our guests today, Brad Wald, Georgina Haynes, Steve Emerson, Nelson Lowry, Rich Garrity, Brian McLean, and Rose Bond. The audio for this show, as well as our extended interviews, can be found on our archive page, kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And you can keep up with us on Twitter, @wordsandpicture.